Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Ranveer Mungat. Ranveer is the co-founder and chief operating officer of InsightRx. Ranveer, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Christian. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Let's start with InsightRx. What problem is it solving in the marketplace?
Absolutely. So InsightRx, we're trying to solve the problem of one-size-fits-all dosing. So when you look at healthcare and you see the dosing protocols that are out there, they're typically designed for, you know, a one-size-fits-all patient. And we provide a software that basically enables precision dosing and clinical analytics. So it's a software tool that sits in the medical record. And basically, it helps the pharmacist personalize dosing for a patient based on their pharmacology, their biomarkers, et cetera.
And what was the genesis behind the idea to launch the company?
So a lot of this spun out of a UCSF, University of California, San Francisco. There was a lab there that the bone marrow transplant group, they were looking for a way to use a predictive model to help dose patients that were receiving chemotherapy before a bone marrow transplant. Hmm. And they had a model they wanted to put into a software that was very usable for them in the clinic. And we kind of took that idea and said, there are probably other drugs that you can use this technology for. And, you know, our background is we were in pharma companies and we build these mathematical models during clinical development. And you have these available to you to kind of design the drug, design the clinical program before you submit to the FDA and select your dose. So we thought, you know, we could probably take these models and do more of this work where we take a model, make it really user-friendly to use in the clinic, and, you know, doctors and pharmacists can help that with dosing patients to be more precise and optimize medications.
And so just for the benefit of our audience, where do the clinical guidelines come from that assist guide for physicians when they have to make?
If you think about the drug development paradigm, it all starts in the pharma companies. So as you go through phase one, phase two, and phase three, the pharma companies are trying to figure out what is the optimal dose for a patient.
Okay.
And part of the issue is in that process, they have to try and make it, you know, somewhat simple so that when it goes into the real world, into the clinic, it's easy for the mass population to follow that dosing guidance. And that's okay with certain drugs that we call them, they have a wide therapeutic index. So, you know, it doesn't really matter. The dosing makes a difference, but there's a wide band where if you dose too much, you know, you may not have an adverse event, or if you dose too low, you may have some lack of efficacy. But there's a whole bunch of drugs where it's really important on the exposure the patient receives. And there you want to optimize the outcome. You want to give enough so it works, but you don't want to give too much where you have an adverse event. And that's where we try to help that process and make it more personalized for a patient.
So it makes good sense. And, you know, for the benefit of our audience, you know, who are not as familiar with the healthcare industry, one of the overriding trends over now greater the past decade is a transition from, you know, fee for service for pay for performance, where there's a big emphasis on outcomes. How does that shift play into InsightRx's broader strategy? Because it sounds like it's playing directly to your mission.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think what we've seen is when we try to do our ROI or analysis, it really depends on the indication and the medication that you're going for. So, you know, some categories, like let's say a bone marrow transplant or anemia management, the pay for performance reimbursement model is like well established there. So it you can map your value prop to that quite easily. But that isn't always the case. And especially when you're in healthcare, it's in our case, we're selling to the pharmacy. And the pharmacy is more of a cost center. So trying to translate sometimes to the fact that maybe you're saving on adverse events, that goes to someone else's budget or line item, maybe the CMO. So trying to thread the needle all the way through, it can be challenging. And you know, we just find it depends on the indication, depends on the therapeutic area that we're going for, if you can really map your ROI to pay for performance or that type of model. It really depends. The other thing I will say is that if you're dealing with insurance companies, they are, in our experience, they are looking at their top 10 problems or even their top 5 problems. And the amount of scale you need to have to be able to have a value prop for an insurance company, it's pretty massive. So you have to be dealing with something like chronic disease or some huge swath of their population, which is causing a whole bunch of losses. And that's where maybe you'll get the attention of an insurance company if you're looking for payer-based reimbursement or have a payer involved.
So it makes really good sense that you're focused on the ROI, but that you also, given your buyers or pharmacies, that you have to understand what's important to them. I would think it seems fair to assume that pharmacies and payers would have their interests aligned, but maybe that's not the case. What sense can you give us between the two groups?
Oh yeah, I think the whole reimbursement model with medications is a little wacky. You might have heard of PBMs and incentives around all that. End of the day though, in the hospital, the pharmacy, is that cost center, right? They have to purchase those drugs and they have them in their formulary, and then they're getting reimbursed from the insurance company after it's been dispensed. So there's some margin there, but if you can show that you're reducing drug cost, either because you're using a generic or using less of the drug, or you're more efficient with your medication, that can certainly be a value prop for pharmacy as well, that kind of cost reduction, right? The other place where we look at ROI is even just operational. So if the types of medications we work with, there's a lot of operational procedure around those. So they're getting blood levels from patients, have to time the samples. There's a lot of wastage there, and you can find that, hey, you can optimize the way that you just run your dosing operation, and see some cost savings as well. So there are multiple angles you can work at.
I was about to say, as I listened to you, it seems really intuitive, but I wasn't necessarily thinking about it up until this point. I would love to unpack your journey to product market fit. Before we do, if we can take a step back, would love to know what your career progression looked like leading up to co-founding InsideRx.
Yeah, definitely. So my background's in biomedical engineering, biotech, and my first after my graduate degree, I went into a company called Genentech. You might be familiar with that. It's a pretty famous biotech company, and there I was basically in the clinical pharmacology department, and that's a department that basically figures out the right dose for a medication. So through from phase one to all the way to phase three, even preclinical, you're doing what's called PK/PD modeling. That's pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic modeling, where you're building these models that try to describe the pharmacology of a drug in a patient, and you do clinical trials and you kind of learn and confirm how the drug is working. And then you pick your dose, which you then submit to the FDA for approval, and that goes into the label, which then in the clinic, that's what people would, give patients. So, I was fortunate enough, at a company like that where you get to see the whole process. You get to work on drugs that are in phase one all the way to phase three and post-marketing. And at that time, my two colleagues, co-founders, they were at UCSF, and that's when they were approached by one of the labs at the hospital to help build that software. And I think all the ideas kind of converged where Just this concept of being able to take those PK/PD models, which we use in pharma, why can't we make that accessible to the pharmacist and, physicians in the real world with real world patient data and allow them to make decisions on patients that are personalized to that patient? So it seemed pretty intuitive. And, I suppose, your question about this journey of product market fit, I love that question because I think that's basically the core of any startup is so you're on this journey to find product market fit. And it's how do you do that? So for us, that genesis came from that bone marrow transplant group at UCSF. And then we were able to talk to other people, a group at Stanford. They were interested in dosing a different drug and with the same methodology. So that kind of gave us more confidence that this is applicable, in a variety of different medications. And more importantly, is someone willing to pay for this? Can you show the ROI? Can you make that argument? And is it important enough for someone to pay for it and sign a contract? So in my opinion, I think that's the piece that is often missing or very hard to figure out. Or if you can figure that out, it's a big step forward. Because a lot of the time you may have a solution and it's great on paper, people agree with it, they like it, but you have to think about your post product market fit, how are you gonna sell? And when I think of product market fit, it isn't just like people think this is cool. It's that they want to buy it now and they need it now. And it can't be like, oh, this is nice. I'd like to have it. It has to be a must-have. It has to be like a top five, top 10 problem that they're facing. Just because there's so much friction on the other side, go through procurement, go through budgets, all the things you have to go through to actually make an enterprise sale. It's very difficult. So part of product market fit is that question that they like it, it's valuable to them. Are they going to pay for it?
Said another way, you can't run payroll with warm fuzzies. It's not
Exactly.
going to give you money for your solution. I'm curious, do you remember your what you thought your thinking when the hospital approached you and said, "Hey, we see an opportunity here to create a company."
I think that just came from just that entrepreneurial, I think, spirit that we had as co-founders, just innately. I think we always wanted to build a company, and at that point, you're kind of looking for things to do that with. And I think, if you're in a technical space and you can dive deep on something, that's one strategy to thought process around like, oh, I want to go build a company, but what do I do? That's one strategy. You can double down on like a specialist area. So for us, it was obviously PK/PD modeling and being able to move that field forward in a meaningful way, right? And end of the day, if you looked at the thought process behind how drugs are developed, I tried to describe that earlier, where it goes from phase one to phase three into the clinic, that process, and then you end up with a one size fits all dose at the end of it. It's pretty inefficient, and we're thinking you can make this much better. So all these kind of came together, and we're thinking we're solving a big problem. This issue of adverse drug events and one size fits all dosing. It's a huge problem that if you solve it, you're helping a lot of people, providing a lot of value. It's worth that pursuit. So that was part of the thought process, behind it.
So, without re revealing any trade secrets or details, did the hospital end up investing in InsideRx, and did they become a customer?
Yeah, so they became a customer, for sure. But it wasn't in a place where the hospital is going to be investing in Insight. It was more like, this was an academic project, type of thing. it was kind of like an internal academic project. And the model that we're using was off the shelf. It wasn't anything proprietary. It was just a model which they had developed in their lab, and they just wanted to put it into a UI that was usable for them, because otherwise you'd have to use specialist modeling software, and your average pharmacist is not going to know how to use that or be proficient in that. So really making that like a usable application. And then from there, of course, we've done more in terms of making more models and our process and how we do the predictions. It's changed, but initially it was just that simple use case.
I mean, kudos to you. I mean, talk about being in the right place at the right time. But I also think it's really valuable because it validates this idea that there is value in having domain expertise. Because arguably the opportunity wouldn't have presented itself had you not been at Genentech, had you not been in the space,
Absolutely. I think that's definitely one strategy. You can you sit on domain expertise, and I think a lot of investors tend to like that. Someone knows their space really deeply. We can talk about Gen AI stuff, but in my opinion, I think you're basically going to see a lot of software, a lot of technology be rewritten, and it requires like those domain experts to understand deeply about how their field works, and then how you could apply Gen AI to improve it. But knowing who you want to sell to, and knowing because you used to be the customer type of thing, can be very valuable. And people who ask me about they want to start a company, I try to just say, okay, look around you and say, what's a problem that you have every day that you want to fix and that you have experience with. Maybe it's in your company, maybe it's in your personal life. And I think you can find a lot of value in just that.
100%. We could probably devote an episode to just this idea of, when founders are going to market, you're coming with a solution to somebody's problem. The features and functions are just how you achieve it. And I think it's really, really wise words. And for any of our first-time entrepreneurs or budding entrepreneurs who are listening to this, it's been a reoccurring theme on the podcast series, just this understanding of who your clients are, what are their pain points, and are they going to give you money for how you want to address them? I think it makes great sense. How many years has InsideRx been operating?
It just hit 10 years this year. So
Congratulations.
it's been a long journey, and we've been through a lot of how do you want to call it, hype cycles. But we've been able to see that the economic cycles and hype cycles and ups and downs of what's happening, and it's interesting to reflect on that as well. Companies that started out when we started 10 years ago, and which ones have been successful, which ones haven't been successful, and kind of being able to see all that play out over a 10-year period, has been pretty eye-opening. So yeah, that's been interesting.
What are some of those key takeaways that night?
I think one of them is it's basically it's how do you manage that kind of overvaluation environment? So when you come into it, because I'm saying that now because we went through COVID, we went through maybe what's happening now. You kind of have these markets ups and downs, and it's just being careful, not to get ahead of yourself and raise too much money on too big a valuation, and really focus on your business. And your business will kind of show you where it needs to go if you look at it rationally, right? It's sometimes you do need to raise a lot of capital to because you have to move fast, or there's competition, or the dynamics of your business at that point in time require that. You have to scale extremely fast because if you don't, then someone else is going to, be there and get market share. Sometimes it's maybe that kind of slower build makes more sense. And then, when you may find the right time to strike and really inject capital and expand quickly. But you have to understand your business properly and make those decisions, not just go and get like a really high valuation and get excited, because that can totally kill you when all the hype dies down and all of a sudden you're in down rounds and that kind of stuff happens. So I think we've seen some of those stories.
I agree 100%. And it can be, I don't know if stressful is the right word, but we read press releases about some of these companies raising massive rounds and massive valuations, and I think our first thought should be, well, what's the revenue multiple? Because to your point, the investors are putting that money in are looking for at least a 3x return. And so, founders beware, you're adding time and expectations to grow your top line to support those investor returns. So I think your assessment is spot on. It's interesting. And so any over the years, any KPIs, markers, anything that's kind of guided you and the rest of the C-suite between making decisions of, hey, it's time to invest in product development versus sales and marketing?
Yeah, I think you see it happening when you have healthy pipeline and your pipeline's converting, right? And we try to have a lot of scrutiny on our pipeline, right? So it isn't like a fake pipeline or pie in the sky ideas around your pipeline. It's real pipeline and real numbers on how it's converting, right? That gives you the like a proper forecast of basically it's good forecasting, right? Can you forecast this nicely into the future? And then manage your spend or go raise more money if you think there's more pipeline or more to get, then you increase sales and marketing, right? Sometimes I think what may end up happening is with the R&D decision, it's I think a lot of companies, when you're first starting out, it's good to focus on one thing, right? You don't have much resources. You can move really fast. That's an advantage. But you focus on one particular thing. And where I'm going with this is sometimes that one thing you picked, the market dynamics on the back end of it may not be exactly what you think they were. The market may not be as big as it was. It may, who knows? But I like this analogy. It was a VC who kind of gave this analogy, and I liked it. It's sometimes you're kind of building, you're getting to your base camp, and that first thing gets you to base camp, and then from there, you've had some reps, you got the customer base, you got your processes rolling. Then from there, you can make a strike to the summit, and really hit it. Sometimes your first hit is right to the summit, but that's not always the case. So it's just trying to understand that, the market dynamics of your first product, how did those pan out? And sometimes, yeah, you then need to have more R&D to then get you to the summit, because it's something else that so there's a next product, or I wouldn't say sometimes a pivot completely. You may have to pivot, but a lot of the time you can add on or something like that, or extrapolate on your market share. So, I think that dictates a lot of whether or not you need to do R&D, right? And then even your end game is, you want to exit quickly? Do you want to, how much legs does this company have in it? Can you go all the way to 100 million ARR? All that starts to, that picture starts to become more clear, obviously the deeper you go, right? You can understand how your company is going to end up and then make decisions based on that. Because not everything's going to be necessarily a unicorn or whatever they're calling it these days.
I still think it's a unicorn.
I think there's like decacorns now and dragons and other things that are,
Some animal, I don't know which one.
yeah.
I'm curious, this is specific to healthcare. has a reputation for being a conservative industry. And so earlier you made reference to just procurement. For what insights can you give us on, just the sales cycle within PBMs? Is it par for the broader healthcare course, or any unique nuances that you get?
So just one minor correction. It isn't to PBMs, it's to the pharmacy or selling direct to hospitals, right? Absolutely, healthcare, it's very tough. And a lot of it's because, they're operating on pretty low margins, these hospitals, and they have a lot going on, and their budgets to spend money aren't massive. So you have to be really providing that ROI. There's a lot of scrutiny around that. So it really has to be a top five, I'd say a top five problem that they need to solve. But then even if it's a top five problem, you're looking at 18-month sales cycles, potentially 24-month, potentially longer. In some cases, you get lucky and it's 1 month, or 2 months. But even when there's a ton of buyer intent, there's a ton of alignment, you're still going to go through that process. And then it just depends on the hospital, on their own bureaucracy. You have to go through IT reviews, through legal, and that can just take time to even get on the backlog of contracting to go through it. And then the other piece is with IT. So, we find that integrating in the medical record with the customer is a huge value prop, because it's in their workflow. It's not a tool they have to go on the side. It's in their everyday, it's like you using, something embedded in your Chrome browser or in Gmail or whatever it is. It's very easy to use. You don't want to be outside the workflow too much. So getting on the IT backlog as well, you have to make sure that your solution is easy to integrate. All that kind of process has to be there. And then of course, change management. If you are going into a hospital and you're updating their dosing practices or something like that, a clinical practice, there has to be a change management process as well. So they have to be prepared for that. Now I think a lot of these same things that I'm talking about apply to, I think, a lot of enterprise sales. Some of them might be easier than others. But yeah, in healthcare, there's a lot to work on. But on the flip side, you get, the your you win on the on the on the on the churn, because it's pretty sticky. Like once you're in the hospital and you're providing value, they don't want to displace you. Because they have to go through the process all over again with somebody else, for example. We have, phenomenal retention numbers.
Fantastic. I'm curious, as a strategy, as I think about a breakdown of reoccurring, so new expansion and churn, if your churn is low, but you have to deal with 18-month cycles on new, do you put a heavy emphasis on expanding once you close?
Absolutely, right. So, part of our challenge was, we're introducing a whole new technology into a healthcare setting. So part of the, the last 5 years even, has just been getting pharmacy familiar with using a PK/PD predictive model and like patient forecasting. And then it's like, space age stuff in their medical record. And how do you get familiar with that and get comfortable with that? But I think we've gone through that education, educating the market on how to use these tools, and then, absolutely, then you're working on expansion to apply this to many therapeutic areas, because there are many problems to solve and with dosing with this technology. And that's the exciting part. That's the part where you're looking at expansion and growth, and that's the kind of journey that we're on now, and it's been very exciting.
Smart. Artificial intelligence obviously has everybody's attention. I would assume, I'll let you tell me otherwise, but I would assume that it's increasing awareness amongst the pharmacies of tech solutions, software solutions that are on market. Love to get your perspective, and then how are you thinking about or how are you incorporating AI into InsightRx's roadmap?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny you say that because we were doing, before Gen AI, AI was your machine learning, your kind of vision forecasting, that's our flavor of AI. And it's funny how with Gen AI, it's becoming more kind of consumer, commonplace. The average consumer understands it better because of ChatGPT, or they feel more comfortable with it. So what's we're seeing that halo effect happen on other machine learning AI techniques as well, like ours. So that's been nice to see, where people are, don't look at AI as such, like, oh my, this is such a new thing, I'm afraid of it. They feel more comfortable with even just machine learning. So that's been nice to see, that halo effect. But now, obviously, with Gen AI, that's a whole other type of capability you have. And I think, people, different opinions. I think you're going to see pretty much every software, every industry vertical be kind of rewritten around and a Gen AI native stack, or user interface, or technology stack. And that's happening now. And it's tricky because what does that look like? So even on our own, we're doing some we have some new products that are coming out that are purely Gen AI native. So they're designed with Gen AI as the front line, and that's been an exciting journey. I think a lot of companies are probably gonna be doing this. But a lot of learnings there as well, because it's a different modality of interacting with the software. And I think the first introduction that people have seen is obviously ChatGPT, that modality of, like, you just have a chat window and a chat bot, and you're orchestrating your tasks from there.
I would presume, so not only is it yield efficiency in terms of automation, but I would also think it makes it improves facetiousness, is that a word? makes your output more efficient, because now you can learn faster, given what's the most appropriate dosage and why.
I think it does two things. So number one, you're correct operationally, right? I think there's a ton of industry verticals where you can speed up operations, and show ROI there, just because you can synthesize data, what required a human to maybe look through and summarize something, or put together pieces of information, or like drive an automated process. You can orchestrate that with an agent or an agentic workflow. So absolutely, operational efficiency. So that's one layer that we're also attacking. The other layer is, where it supports the clinical piece, that is then the synthesis of information, and then making a decision based off of that. Now, the tricky part there is, of course, when you're making clinical decisions, it's a very high bar you have to meet. And one of the inherent problems with, not problems, but challenges with Gen AI is that it's, you put the same prompt in, you don't always get the same result. So you have to be careful. You have to blend it with, if you're doing a calculation, or you're doing something where it might be better to have, to write some code where it's more deterministic, use those modalities for those types of problems. But in cases where you need to maybe summarize information, or look at multiple sources and collate that information, and then get a recommendation out of it, Gen AI could be a very useful kind of sidekick to help a pharmacist. I still think, though, that you're always going to have a human in the loop. Maybe for another, I'm not going to project how many years, 5 years or 10 years, but until you get that AGI that happens, There'll still be someone in the loop. It's just that they're going to be 10x'd or 100x'd. Each person can do a lot more with these tools, much like how software kind of 10x'd people in the last whatever 20, 30 plus years.
I agree with your assessment. My take is it's gonna we're still years away where AI can accurately discern intent. And so you're gonna have to have a human who can validate results to say, is this what I was looking for? Whether or not we get to a point where we close that gap, the analogy that's been used before on the podcast is Waymo. Waymo can go from point A to point B, so effectively discerning intent. But it's very specific, so I think it'll evolve. You're right. I don't know if it's 5 years or less or more, but if that, it's a good hallmark or a good feels right. Ranveer, a whole host of great insights. Really appreciate you sharing. Before we wrap up, a couple more questions. I love doing retrospectives. I find it yields a lot of insights. But if you had an opportunity to go back and have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
I think the experience of going through and building a company and going through these challenges of product market fit and sales cycles and all these things, I would definitely, I think I'd be able to go back and give myself a lot of advice on just how to think about problems and how to approach them and how to solve them. When you first start out, it's you're kind of learning as you're going, right? And we still are, right? But we've gone through that 10 years of pain, so to speak. But I think it's more around the just that focus on that product market fit, being that kind of rapid iteration and that high throughput, that kind of, so those cycles is what kind of gets you to the finish line almost, or along your journey. And that's your competitive advantage. Like that's what lets you outcompete like a big company or someone with more resources is you're more focused on the problem and you have those iteration cycles that can ultimately kind of win you the race. That's a good strategy. And I think you can apply this in any industry. We got stuck in, not stuck with, but we're working in this vertical. But even in my everyday life, I have to deal with like finances and legal and data compliance or security compliance. There's a startup and there's a company in every one of those layers. Basically, everything that everyone's doing right now, it can be done better. There's an opportunity to do almost everything better. And that's how you have all these companies that keep popping up. There's so many problems to solve all around you. You just got to keep a lookout and understand like what that problem is, and it can be done better. I almost guarantee it.
I agree. And I mean, there's my experience has been the same. I mean, there's tremendous value in speed. It shortens the learning curve and enables you to adapt, iterate to the market and better position a company to remain competitive. Excellent. I agree. Ranveer, last question. Anyone in your life, whether personal or professional, you'd love to give a shout out to who's had a meaningful impact on who you've come today.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, to my co-founders, absolutely, Serge and Ron. It's been a tough journey for us is a lot of pain along the way. But just being able to navigate these problems and have both of them as like partners to think through these problems and think through the strategy and be a sounding board. That's been very helpful, obviously. And then just that kind of camaraderie of like working through all this. I mean, yeah, so definitely them. The other person I would give a shout out is probably my dad as well. I think this one is it's more about the just like that curiosity and wanting to solve problems and build companies. That kind of outlook on, you see it could be any industry. You see something and you're thinking, how could this be done better? Or thinking entrepreneurially about anything really. Just that kind of that thought process and introducing me to that. And I think that definitely influenced me in my life. And then the other part of it is just being able to manage the emotional roller coaster of startups and life and yeah, it's easy to get wrapped up in it and it can play a big toll on you, but you have to learn how to manage that as well. So I think he does a good job of managing, crises in life and business or whatever it is. So, definitely my dad.
Fantastic. Well, kudos to Serge and Ron. I love it. Great case for co-founders. It is hard, and being able to shoulder the weight with, a great group of other entrepreneurs, very fortunate. And then, God bless dads and parents in general. I like you, was very fortunate to have a great role model. So that's fantastic. What's his name?
It's a tripod.
Trifat. Well, shout out to Trifat. Ranveer, if there are any members of our audience that would like to get a hold of you or learn more about InsideRx, where can they find you?
LinkedIn, obviously, or look us up at insight-rx.com and reach
Perfect.
out.
Good stuff. Well, with that, Ranveer, thank you again. I appreciate your time. Very insightful podcast. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Ranveer Mangat, co-founder and chief operating officer of InsideRx. Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.